Hola, and welcome to the Retro Computing Roundtable, show number 28. White, but no matter where I go, there's one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? This is the podcast about computer history and collecting and nostalgia and news, and we let Earl Evans out of his box. It's madness. And since the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, it must be the dawning of the age of the Carrington. And by a staggering coincidence, my name just happens to be Carrington Vanston, so I get to be host this time.
Follow the script.
I am just every stool has three legs, and I'm just one sample of those. So I will be joined by two other stool samples. First up, he's podcasting from Georgia, straight into your hearts and minds. It's country singing superstar David Grealish. How are you, David?
Hola, or hola, hola. I don't know Spanish. So, guten Tag.
Guten Tag.
Yeah. How's it going, Carrington?
We are so multicultural. It's awesome.
I brought my own stool.
I'm proud of that. It's going excellently. And you, David?
Really nice. And yeah, to bring up an oldie favorite topic, the weather. It is like, it could not be more beautiful here in the greater Atlanta area. I mean, it's like totally clear, blue sky, sunny, just breezy. I don't know what the temperature is going to be, but it's like warm, but just the crispness of the cool air. Yeah, I mean, it's just perfect. It's like the absolute perfect day here right now.
Which David said as he drops the mic.
I know. That's what I'm thinking. I'm out of here.
Okay, so let's bring in our other leg from the unfortunately named stool. joining us from Portland, Oregon. He's the newest YouTube sensation, but hopefully this time his clothes will stay on. It's Earl Evans. How are you, Earl?
Hey. Ohio gozaimasu. I'm doing really good. How are you guys?
Excellent.
Now, so, what was that? What'd you say?
I said kind of hello, good morning.
kind of hello.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, you know, you use Ohio as just a general greeting, but it can, you know, it technically Ohio gozaimasu is good morning. So, good morning. Okay. It's still morning here. It's not morning for you guys.
Yeah. No, we are ahead. We are in the future. I can tell you what's going to happen to you for the next few hours.
Right.
I get on Google so awesome. You.
It says, "Yo, Earl Evans arrested." It's like, uh-oh.
And that, ooh, that's bad. Back to the future. So the weather here is
Oh, really?
It's not bad. It's not good. At least it's not like pouring rain. So I can deal with it.
Exactly.
A little bit of blue sky out there.
Here in Canada, in Toronto, right in Canada. Yeah,
all of Canada.
In Toronto, it was supposed to be pretty much pouring rain all weekend, but while it's overcast, it is not raining, so I'm pleased about that.
Very nice.
Yeah. So shall we talk retro stuff? Shall we dive into the news?
Yes.
The promised news? Okay, Earl, since you have the worst weather, you get to have the first bit of news. Tell me about 6502 emulation.
Well, I'm not going to tell you all about 6502.
No, tell me all about it.
That it took a long time. But so my son plays a game called Minecraft. Have either of you ever played it?
I haven't played it, but
I know about it.
And my son plays it too.
Your shows. Yeah, we've spoken about it. So the that fellow who created a replica of an Apple II.
That's right. That's right. Well, in this case, you know, it's gotten even crazier that now there's a 6502 emulator in Minecraft. So I'm guessing that the Minecraft environment must be extensible with either some sort of API or, you know, in-game, like, content programmable sort of stuff. And again, I don't know anything about developing for Minecraft, but it must be powerful enough that they're able to create a virtual computer in-game. So you can go in, you can play with this 6502, you can program it in Forth, apparently. He's even put in a nice front panel that looks like a deck PDP-8.
Yeah, awesome.
Those nice flip switches and stuff like that. I'm amazed at how powerful this environment must be to allow this kind of extension. And I'm just amazed at this work. I mean, if you guys saw it, it's a thing of beauty. I almost want to get Minecraft for myself so I can go in and play with this virtual computer.
And the weird thing is, as if like just doing a basic 6502 wouldn't be impressive enough, it supports like all of the 6502 instruction set and the 65C02 and a whole bunch of the 65C18. Like, it's like, come on.
And I think even some of the illegal opcodes.
Now you're just showing off.
Yeah. Well, you know, from the little I know about it is, and I heard about this and I read some stuff and some discussion about it. I don't remember exactly who said this, but I finally read a really great explanation where someone said, you know, so it's sort of a virtual world, and the entire world is sort of like Lego building blocks. So you can completely customize the world, or in this instance, you know, the person or us, if we go check this out, we're in the world, but now this person has built, you know, has made a Lego Apple II, if you will, Minecraft inside the world. And then, but then, in other words, it can pull stuff in from the outside, like this code and functionalities. And so it seems very customizable. So I think that whole Lego analogy seems – that made it click for me a little bit better. Because I've seen my son playing with it, and that's exactly Lego, like you're scooping out squares or cubes, and you're adding cubes, and you're, you know, you're building and removing and building and moving and stuff, and customizing it to look like things. And so he's – I know he's spent a lot of time making sort of like a house. And
it does seem like a very creative game. So,
now, David, did you? He's been spending all that time building a house. Did you turn to him and say, "That's not impressive. I want to see emulation."
Right. What about what the other kids are doing?
Yeah.
No, exactly. I thought it was pretty impressive what he showed me. I thought it was cool. And
6502 seems to be the most emulated of chips. Like, it seems every time I turn around, there's some new version of an emulator somewhere for the 6502.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think so many of the early popular machines were based on that chip, you know, the Apple, the Atari, the PET. So that makes sense.
Yeah, I think because it was sort of the classic consumer's 8-bit processor. You know, even though the 8080, of course, was also, but that was more the hobbyist, you know,
right,
first generation 8-bit, you know, processor.
Plus, the 6502 will soon have its own movie.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, from Jason Scott?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't see any 8088 movies coming.
That's a 16-bit.
Yeah, needs twice as many bits. That's what I'm saying. So, David, what have you got for us? Something to do with videos and Kansas Fest?
Never heard. Yeah, and actually, whoops. See, real quick before we leave the last topic, though. Yeah, the 8088, is that pretty much, is that all it ever existed in? Primarily was the IBM PC. I mean, I think so, right? There weren't really any other uses of
it? I don't remember what chip they used in that Victor series of computers. I think it might have been an 8086, but boy, I'm, you know, digging through the memory here. Somebody Wikipedia it. But that set of computers that Chuck Peddle had worked on,
mm-hmm,
and they were, you know, not really IBM compatible. I think they, in some ways, predated that stuff.
Mm. Well,
yeah, I can't think of anything where I
but yeah, other you know, major computer models, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, so moving back to my topic here. So basically, Ken Gagne tweeted out, was it yesterday or just recently, where he, or the Kansas Fest people have uploaded 44 videos to YouTube, and there's a link in the show notes, you know, to their YouTube channel. So basically, you can watch lots of up to 44 different sessions, or 44 new sessions have been added from 1995 to 2011 from Kansas Fest, which is upcoming, by the way. And just, mm-hmm, we're counting down to 6 weeks or so.
I know, I can't
something like
wait.
That. So anyway, that's all. So I know I want to check it out. I mean, I got a chance to sort of just look what was there. I haven't got a chance to watch anything.
Yep, basically Kansas Fest has its own YouTube channel, so you can go and subscribe to that. At the same time, you could subscribe to the little RCR channel, just saying. And
it's,
yes,
great,
fantastic.
They've been capturing,
yes,
that, you know. It's really awesome that they've captured all that stuff over the years.
Absolutely, yes. If I recall, they've got videos from 2009 through 11, and also 2007, and some from back in 1995, or one from back in 1995.
Oh, okay. Oh, so they don't have, like, one from every year, I guess. I know they also have, like, audio and stuff.
It's mostly from 2010, 2011. Just because, you know, as the years go on, there's more and more of us walking around with decent video recording things. And
yeah.
There's been more of a push to record and capture bits of the event.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think it's awesome. And of course, we'll have links to the Kansas Fest YouTube channel in the show notes, as we will for all of the things that we talk about. So I'm going to bring it down to my level a little bit now, guys. Earl talks about brilliant emulation of a classic chip in a newfangled game. David brings us back to history and upcoming events and exciting things. I want to talk about a beer cabinet. So the Arkeg is an arcade cabinet and beer keg combined. So it's like imagine a big main cabinet, but with a beer tap on the side of it. You fill it with a keg, you play games. I believe their slogan is drink, game, Arkeg. And so it's just something
that's funny.
You can both purchase one, or if you're in the States, you can rent them. Purchase, they're a little expensive. I think it was something like $4,000. Mm-hmm. And it takes $1,000 to reserve one. But it comes basically as your standard preloaded MAME cabinet with a whole bunch of games, and it also comes with the CO2 tank and a temperature control and all of that. But if you're just having a party, for instance, you can rent one, and it's $150, I think, to rent one per day. So if you just wanted to sort of borrow one for a party, that could be a fun addition. It just, you know, it was sort of a neat little retro thing, and I hadn't seen anything like it. So I thought I would draw everyone's attention to it. Draw is, of course, a beer pun. I work on many levels.
Yeah, I'm sure it's just sort of a, you know, it's not very practical, really, in a lot of ways, but it's just a fun thing to add to a party, a novelty.
Oh, I think it might be practical. I've noticed, you know, the more you have beer, the better you play the arcade games, or at least that's how it seems.
I think we need to bring one to Kansas Fest and test that theory.
But Earl, that's got to be a bell curve, I'm thinking. Or, you know, so in other words, your ability increases to a point, and then hopefully it takes a real noticeable dive down.
Not if you're Jonathan. You guys remember WKRP, and they did that thing where his reactions got faster and faster when he drank more and more?
Well, oh, yeah.
I think more empirical data collection is necessary.
Absolutely.
WKRP.
So, Earl, speaking of video games and doing poorly at them, have you played Wolfenstein Online?
I did, and I'll recommend to people that you learn how to shoot before you start playing the game, because if you don't, you'll die the death of a ragdoll. But if you played Wolfenstein 3D, you know, one of the primordial 3D shooters, did you guys play it?
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a lot, but some.
Yeah, I loved this game. You know, it was just, again, the first time being thrown into one of those 3D environments and you're running around and you're shooting stuff, it's like, wow, hey, this is pretty fun, actually. So if you want to relive those memories, you can do it online. We will have a link up in the show notes. It runs pretty well. It's pretty darn smooth.
Yeah, and totally free. I think it was put online by Bethesda to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Wolfenstein 3D.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that ties in with Kansas Fest from the point of view that, of course, John Romero will be the keynote speaker, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And him and John Carmack were the developers of this. And then after that, Doom and a whole bunch of stuff.
Right. Now, for me, Doom, because of some friends of mine, was kind of the first real video game I ever kind of really played, you know, PC sort of, I don't know, 3D-like. Oh, I like, kind of messed around with Wolfenstein a little bit. But I actually went to a couple of, what do you call those? Net parties, I guess? Net game, you know?
Land parties.
Yeah, land parties. There you go. And I'm trying to think how they connected to each other. I don't think it wasn't with network cables.
Yeah, it was probably with network cables. Probably with Ethernet. We used to do that. I had a group of friends. We used to, all Mac guys, so we played a lot of Marathon. I was hooked on Marathon. And then later things like Duke Nukem and its sort of knockoff games. But we used to get together quite often and lug around our PowerPC Macintoshes and get together and hook them all up into an impromptu network at somebody's house and play for many a hour. I loved it. Adored playing Marathon.
And of course, I was, you know, absolutely a pure Mac person back then, but I remember one friend of ours who had recently got a new computer, a PC, he brought it. So he had a Pentium 60, you know, which is like the very first generation Pentium, right? And this is before, I think, even Windows 95, but that thing was like screaming. It was like ridiculous how fast it seemed.
What was it screaming? Was it, it was Macintosh,
I just remember, I was impressed with how fast it was, even though I still didn't want it, because I'd rather have my Mac.
Did you guys ever play the original Wolfenstein game on the Apple II?
Of course.
I didn't.
And that was the funniest thing, is that it would actually talk to you. The first time I heard it do that, I was like, holy cow, that's coming out of an Apple II? That is really fun.
I have seen it.
And there's nowhere to go
later on.
So no. let's move on.
Well, actually, the sound sampling was a pretty major breakthrough, wasn't it?
For Castle Wolfenstein?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I read so. Because I think it was released originally for the Apple II, and then it was ported to, DOS and Atari and Commodore 64.
And then later, even game consoles, wasn't it?
Like, yeah, there were a lot of games that had sound samples back then. For me, the first sound sample game that ever really, really resonated with me was the arcade game Sinistar, when it would yell, "I'm hungry," and all that. Like, that was, for me, early sound sampling is all about Sinistar.
I remember the first game that ever talked to me that I thought was, whoa, that's pretty fun, was Gorf. You know, like the arcade version, the stand-up version. Like, you'd go play that.
Classic game.
The Gorf dude would, taunt you, you know?
I loved Gorf, but I'm trying to think, in Castle Wolfenstein, I think there was only a couple of things. Like, he would yell in German or whatever, but I can't remember. He would yell halt, I guess, but I'm sure there was other ones, too.
I think there were. Well, actually, you know, if you want to talk about that kind of thing, wasn't there SAM for the Apple II? The software automated mouth program?
Oh,
it was a speech synthesizer.
Oh, my God. I forgot all about that. Yeah, there absolutely was. Yes.
Yeah. SAM was cool. I mean, now, sometimes it's a little hard to understand, but, you know, it came out for a lot of the different platforms, but I remember it. Yeah, I think the first time I ever heard it was on an Apple II, if memory serves.
Sure, absolutely. I used it on an old Apple IIe. Yeah. Wow, bringing back memories. But let's leap forward, since we've determined that Earl is terrible at Wolfenstein 3D Online because he doesn't know how to shoot. David, tell me about your experiences of the web. What's this missing link thing you want to talk about?
Well, it's just a recent article up at Ars Technica, and it's about the and actually, is it upcoming? So it was just written a couple days ago. I guess it's – well, in any case – somewhere within this time frame now is the 25th anniversary of HyperCard.
And I still miss it.
And yeah, so you have some experience with it, Carrington?
Oh, God, yeah, tons.
And Earl, do you know what it is? And have you ever done anything with it?
I do. Yeah, we used it at Hughes Aircraft, actually. Use it for a few different things.
Cool. Oh, well, you know, and also I recently uploaded that old video of mine from 1992 where I actually showed my computer at the time, and I was working on a HyperCard stack. And so HyperCard, I've never been a programmer, never really been a coder. And so HyperCard was kind of the closest thing I ever came to sort of being a programmer. You know, I actually learned a little bit of the HyperTalk, you know.
Sure.
But it's just cool. It's a neat program, not to be forgotten. An interesting article, so check it out. It mentions the five cool historical HyperCard stacks, one being Myst was huge in the 1993 time frame, and there was even an earlier one called the Manhole, which I have a
which
copy
is available
of that.
On iOS now. You can get Manhole.
But it really talks about how HyperCard kind of was all the components of the web, but not networked. If that makes sense. So it was sort of like, I mean, it had hypertext and hyperlinks, and you could do video and audio and sort of interactive and. It's just kind of cool. And then the guy who developed it, Bill Atkinson, who was very integral to the Macintosh, there's a mention here of an interview he did in 2002 where he confessed that he kind of, it's just Apple really missed a big opportunity with it. In a lot of ways, they could have turned it into maybe a web interface early on.
Yep.
And tied it into the web or the internet. And they just sort of, it just sort of languished for a long time.
Well, there were ways to put your HyperCard stacks online as well later on. Like HyperCard, there was a couple of kludgy ways that you could basically host them and view online as the web got popular and stuff. I loved HyperCard. I did a lot of HyperCard development also in things like SuperCard, which is basically a little higher-end color version of HyperCard. But
and that,
Apple just sort of lost interest in HyperCard. It became very clear that they were moving on and leaving HyperCard behind. But yeah, I still miss it. I loved HyperCard. It's one of the best things about early Macintosh stuff.
Yeah, and it really did, you know, again, I'm not a programmer at all. And it really opened up that sort of graphical programming environment, you know, where I could actually do some cool things with it.
And so fast. I used it a lot as a prototyping tool. So because you could knock together a working program as a prototype so fast in something like HyperCard.
And I know that HyperCard was used a lot for like kiosks especially.
Yep. I did some of that development myself. My family used to own a very large cyber cafe in Toronto, and part of the front end of that was developed in SuperCard, which is very similar to HyperCard.
Yeah.
When I had to knock together just login screens, that kind of stuff really quickly for a very rapid launch. So it was done that and communicated back to a SQL database and stuff. And yeah, wow. I really liked it. I was always a big fan of HyperTalk, the language, and because I was very familiar with it, and it's clear that HyperTalk and Apple Script, I was going to say Apple Talk, HyperTalk and Apple Script are clearly relatives, but they're different enough that I for many years would mess up Apple Script quite often because I would use HyperTalk terminology, and it wasn't quite the same, even though it sort of looked the same. So yeah, it used to mess up my Apple scripting.
So, I mean, a great article. There's more to it than even what we've talked about. So it also talks about Ted Nelson, who is kind of considered the father, I think. Well, I don't know if that's true either, but of hypertext. I'm trying to think who was the other guy that mentioned hyperlinks and stuff. Anyway, read the article. Some good stuff here, especially if you're a fan of HyperCard. So, and it's still fun to play around with. I've actually saved a lot of my other, my stack that I made. You know, I finished that stack, and the last thing I was going to do was put pictures in it. And I had difficulty figuring out how to bring images into it, and then that part of it never got finished. That'd be kind of a neat thing to do, to try to finish that.
Do it. We'll wait.
But, you know, I have some other stacks that are computer history related from the time frame that are fun. It's fun to mess around with. So,
Very cool. So, let's go back a bit. HyperCard, awesome. Early Macintosh, awesome. But before the Macintosh, of course, was the Apple II series, and before the Apple II was the Apple I. And there are two of them for auction at the moment. There is one on eBay and one coming up at Sotheby's. The one on eBay is an original Apple I. It's got the cassette interface card. It has an opening bid of $35,000, and it has a bid. So right now, if you want to get involved, you got to chuck up $35,100 or more. So it's going to sell. It's not available to Canada. Otherwise, of course, I'd be bidding.
That's crazy. Why wouldn't you make this worldwide? Just because it's too much too risky for the seller?
Reality is, I think most people on eBay in the States don't. I think by default, it just makes it your own country. I often find things that I'm interested in, and I'll email the person saying, would you willing to ship to Canada? And almost always they say, oh, I didn't know I was saying I couldn't. So so what do you guys think? Going to cough up $35,000?
It's chump change.
I've got to think it's going to go higher. I don't know how much higher. I mean, look at the Sotheby's one is, what does it say?
Yeah, and so that's the other one. So the Sotheby's, they're expecting their Apple I to go for between $120,000 and $180,000. Now, the Sotheby's one is a fully functional one with a lot of provenance behind it, and there's a great catalog note. If you look at the Sotheby's, and we'll have links to both auctions, obviously, in the show notes over at rcrpodcast.com. But when you go look at the Sotheby's auction, it's you're going to want to read the notes behind it. So they're expecting a much higher price for the Sotheby's one.
Yeah, and I've got to think they'll get it, but I don't know.
I don't think it matters. It wouldn't matter to me as a buyer that it works. I've shared this with you guys before. That
me either.
If I have something in my collection. And, my collection is rather pedestrian compared to people who are going to be bidding on an Apple I. But I want stuff that works and that I'm not scared to power on.
Yeah.
Every single time I flip the power switch on that Apple I, I would be just shaking in my boots going, what if the chips fry? And then all of a sudden, all that money that I spent for a, quote, working Apple I, now it's not working anymore.
And it's not the same thing of, like, turning the ignition or cranking or whatever of a Model T Ford, because it's not the same thing. You could, especially if you have the money and means, of course, but you can kind of keep up the Model T Ford and keep it running, and sure, you can take it down the street and stuff, but with the Apple I, one time and it could fry the whole thing. I mean, I guess theoretically you could get it repaired, but
well, you can with some effort. There's a fella at the Seattle, the the Seattle group, mm-hmm. the historical group that meets up there.
The Living Computer Museum.
That meets at the Living Computer Museum, right. There's a fellow that has created a Apple I replica. This isn't like the one that you would get, say, from Brill or whatever.
Oh, right.
This is a real scale replica of the Apple I with, you know, board print, original chips.
Yeah, it's a replica, not a work-alike.
Exactly. And it's cost him a decent amount of money to go out and find some of these original chips, but you can do it. I mean, you could put this together mm-hmm. if you had a mind to, and obviously for significantly less expense than buying a real one. If you're buying this, I guess my point was that I'm making and taking way too long to make. If you're buying this, you're buying it for its historical value, and to me, it really doesn't matter if it works or not.
Yeah, it's now transcended into being an artifact. It's a museum piece. It's something to be protected and put behind glass and all that. So you're not to touch it. You don't mess with it. It's to look at.
Right.
Here's a real one. See it? Wow, isn't that great? You don't see that very often. But, right. You know, that's it. It's all you get to do with it.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. I would far rather drop the $35,000 for the one on eBay, working or not, versus, you know, say $200,000 for the one from Sotheby's.
But it'll be interesting to see what happens.
The one on eBay will go for more, but there's only 4 days left. It's been up for a while. Only has the single bid, but I'm sure a lot of people have their eye on that auction to see what's going to happen. So,
do you see, when's the date on the Sotheby's one?
That, you know, it's kind of hard to find. Sorry, I did track it down. In fact, I had thought I knew when it was coming up in sometime in June. It is in June, but I think I was incorrect. Somebody over at the forums, which we also have a link to on the rcrpodcast.com site, there's a discussion of these auctions, two different threads discussing the auctions there, and somebody in the forums found it. So I could pop over to there and look. Everyone should pop over to rcrpodcast.com quite often.
Right.
And also check out our site and our blog, which, by the way, I'm the only one who ever posts anything on, even though it was Earl's idea. I got suckered.
But you're doing such a great job at it, Karen.
Whatever.
You're such a tough act to follow.
I totally got suckered. Okay, so anyway, on the site, it seems that it's on the 15th of June. So it's coming up.
Save your pennies.
I need a lot of pennies. So, Earl. Earl,
yes.
Video star Earl, you super YouTube fan boy. Wait, no, that's the opposite. Like, whatever, you superstar. Tell me about your, should we call it a TV debut? What is this?
I guess so. In that's right. I'm on TV. In September of last year, I and my son Joshua and his good buddy Ben, who is a budding video producer, just does a fantastic job on videos, putting them together, special effects, all that kind of thing. We all grabbed our gear and went to the Portland Retro Gaming Expo and shot a lot of video, talked to a number of people, enjoyed the show. It was a great time. And then we put together a video of this experience. Now, it took a while to get the video out. Ironically, they're gearing up for the 2012 show at this point, but finally released it on YouTube, and I think that Ben did a really good job putting this together.
So
I'd encourage people to go out and take a look. And
it's a great video. I mean, it's the production value is excellent. I mean, honestly, he did a fantastic job producing this.
Whenever
you introduce somebody new, it sort of freezes and shows all those copies of the person and their title. Like, that's just a cool effect. And I got a real sense of what the Portland Retro Gaming Expo is like the sessions and just walking around and the booths and stuff. And really, it was just a fantastic video.
It was my idea.
Well done, David. Well done.
Way to go, David.
No, I'm telling you.
I haven't seen it yet, Earl, but I'm going to check it out.
The special effects notwithstanding, one of the main purposes was if you couldn't get to the Retro Gaming Expo, here's a flavor of what the Retro Gaming Expo was like. So, Carrington, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that was one of the main objectives for doing the video, was just to promote it and to give people the experience if they couldn't actually have it in person. But if you are in the Pacific Northwest, I'd encourage you to go because it is a ton of fun. They're actually having a much bigger venue this year, and in the show notes we'll have a link to information. You can go out and figure out all the, you know, vital statistics on the 2012 event, which is coming up in September of this year.
Very cool.
Is it and I'm sorry, let me ask you a couple of questions, Earl. Was there any crossover there as far as
Oh, there's tons of
like computer history.
Computers.
Yeah.
I mean,
it seems like it could evolve into also being sort of a, you know, vintage computer festival sort of thing alongside, which obviously highlighting gaming as well, but
you know, there's cross-pollination between the vintage computer world and the vintage gaming world.
Yeah.
But the vintage gaming world also has this personality of its own. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you know, I'm not sure that it would ever morph into anything that was seriously computer-oriented because there's just so much depth and interest in the video games of ye olde, you know.
So it's like a Jets and a Sharks thing?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe so. But and some of the personalities, there's some overlap. But, again, you know, a lot of the personalities are just in the gaming world. Like, for instance, one of the panels there featured David Crane and Gary Kitchen.
Oh, wow, cool.
And these are amazing names in the retro gaming world.
Absolutely.
David Crane, you know, one of the co-founders of Activision, and Gary Kitchen worked with David Crane for many years. Gary Kitchen now, as I understand it, is the head of gaming at Viacom.
Right. And was the force behind Gary Kitchen's Game Maker, of course. So yeah, totally.
Yeah, so these guys, yeah, they have a lot of legacy, and it was great to be able to see them and videotape the session. So anyway, check it out. It's almost 30 minutes, so it's almost a RetroBits episode.
And one last question, Earl. Do you know of anyone else who covered it? So does your video stand as like the video coverage of the event? Or I'm sure it got covered somewhere else, right, too?
Yeah, there's a couple of other videos of
we
the
won't
Retro
link
Gaming
to those.
Expo that are on YouTube. And I think that they do a good job, too, of covering the event. And I would say that they came out significantly before our video came out. Because it really took a long time to get it on the air. If we do the 2012 event, we've got some plans on how to turn this thing a lot faster, maybe within 2 to 4 weeks.
Cool.
Yeah,
well, I think you should, because it's a really enjoyable video and get a real sense of the event. And speaking of events, one is coming up that we haven't spoken of before, so I thought I'd just drop in a link for it. The Classic Console and Arcade Gaming Show 2012 will be taking place in 3 weeks. So it's on we're going to be recording an RCR that day. Maybe I can – it's not that far. It's in Ohio, I think. So that's driving distance.
Well, I see it says Cleveland. Yeah, it says Cleveland.
Or Cleveland. Yeah, sure.
That's in Ohio.
Cleveland. Yeah, well, I'm just like, you know, be more specific. It's all good. But I went to this event once before. A buddy of mine sort of last minute hopped in a car and drove out to it. It's a smallish sort of event, at least it was the time I went. But it was really fun. It was a really fun thing, and I would like to revisit it. So it's on the 23rd of June in, as you say, Chicago, in Cleveland. So
If I can, it's in Fairview Park, Ohio. Of course, you can go to the website and see this. It's only $3 admission.
Canadian. Yeah, like, and that's it. And so there's a number of vendors go there, and it's basically like a little vendor show and stuff. But it was really enjoyable, and there was, you know, I got to check out things, and I made a couple of little game purchases, and just it was a very fun event. And so I'd like to maybe check it out again. Just wanted to give them a shout out, and we'll have a link in the show notes. And the other thing we want to shout out to or talk about just briefly, just touch on, is Byte Magazine has reprinted Steve Wozniak's original Apple II system description from back in 1977. So you can read the original system description article that he wrote and appeared in Byte Magazine. You can also
download the PDF, which is awesome. Cool,
because the PDF is formatted exactly how it's like the actual pages from the original magazine. Really fun to read. I was really – what I found striking – was how much ownership Woz takes. It's written so differently than if the same thing came out now from Apple, where it would talk about, you know, Apple has done this and we have done this. But this article is all about, you know, my vision was this. I made the Apple One. I've now made the Apple Two. I made this decision. Here's why I did that. It's really – it's a guy talking about his computer, and I found it very personal, and that made it all the more interesting to read. I really enjoyed it.
And, you know, it's kind of easy to forget that back then, the early Apple II days, you know, the company just started stuff. I mean, yeah, Apple was pretty much defined by two people, obviously. Steve Jobs on the marketing, I guess sort of public side of it more so. But as far as engineering went, yeah, he was speaking from a personal, I mean, he was engineering at Apple.
Right.
It was his vision, his work, everything. And that rightfully so, and nobody was going to tell him otherwise. It wasn't arrogance. It just was the truth.
So if you're interested in the Apple One history stuff, and probably if you're listening to this podcast, you are, I would strongly recommend you to head over and take a look at the PDF. It's really, really an interesting thing.
And after you read that, if you want a little bit more flavor of that kind of perspective that you guys are talking about, you should read the book I Was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Woz's biography, because that's also very interesting. You know, and you get, again, more of that flavor of I did this, I did that, this was my deal, this is what I was all about. You know, and it's, you know, it's put forth in a very unvarnished kind of way. You know, it's just like, yep, this is my deal. Did you guys read that?
I loved it.
I did. I'd had it for a few years, and I had only gotten about a quarter of the way through, but then I finally bought it at Audible, and so I bought the unabridged, you know, the full book.
Oh,
but
so
I listened to the entire
book on tape.
Yeah, which I really, you know, recommend. If you like podcasts, it seems like you're going to like audiobooks too.
Who was the narrator?
Oh, it wasn't Steve Wozniak, the person was good. I don't remember.
Because it should have been Woz, like on a Segway, and you hear the wind blowing as he's going. It'd be awesome. So if you download the PDF, another thing you get that you don't get if you just look at it online is you can see the ads that accompanied the system. System description. So you see a big full page ad for the Apple II, and then the second page is, you've just run out of excuses for not owning a personal computer, and it talks all about what you get with your Apple II system. And then there is an order form, which I'm sorely tempted to fill out.
I want one. Yeah, let's totally. Do it.
You can get a Apple II board only system starting at only $598, so they kept that sub $600 price that he talks about at the very beginning, and it goes up to, you can spend as much as $2,638 for a fully assembled system with a maxed out 48K RAM, which is frankly ludicrous amount. Nobody would need that much. It's awesome.
Wow. And just an aside here, iWoz is narrated by a man named Patrick Lawlor. And he has 220 books at Audible that he has narrated. So
that's a lot of.
He was very good, and also he makes probably a pretty decent living at this. And if I could ever get Stan Veit books going, maybe I could do that for a living.
It was enjoyable to listen to.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah,
good.
And I love audiobooks.
I hate to say it, but I actually liked it better than what I thought I might. You know, not that I didn't think I'd like it, but I really enjoyed it more than I might have thought. I might have thought
itself. You mean?
Yeah, I really enjoy the book a lot.
So. I just find that the narrator for an audiobook makes such a difference, mm-hmm. whether or not – there was
definitely.
A book that – a business-oriented kind of book my team at work was looking at recently, and you could actually check out the audiobook from a roving – this library thing. You know, all legit, like, you know, they have this
– that.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I listened to it, and I just couldn't take it. The narrator was just not good. It was a harsh voice, you know, grated on my ears. I got through about a chapter, and I was like, I'm done.
I've had that experience, too, with some audiobooks.
I don't like it when I listen to a lot of audio. I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and frequently it'll be a series, and it drives me crazy if they change the narrator mid-series. I'm book five, and it all sounds different. I just like, why would you do this to me?
Oh, yeah, I haven't ever had that happen.
Well, anyway, everyone should run, don't walk, and read Woz's stuff, and ideally go place an order for your own Apple II. There's no, I don't see any expiry date on this coupon, so I say send it in. to Apple Computer Inc. over in Stevens Creek Boulevard in Cupertino.
Don't you do it, David, because you know they're still on you about the museum thing.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, guys. The good thing is it might be a use for some older cards, because you can pay not only by Visa, but you can pay by Bank AmeriCard and MasterCharge.
MasterCharge, so, yeah.
Break out those old cards and try to get yourself an Apple II. So anyway, awesome.
By taking advantage of the latest in technologies, CyberEars offers a simple way to get your audio heard. Your message might be a regular audio talk show you want to release to people, or it might be your music, or it might be the audio recording of a meeting or service, or it might be a way to get important updates to your employees. Whatever your message is, if it can be recorded in sound, CyberEars.com is the mechanism you use to distribute it. We provide you the hosting and marketing tools needed to ensure you get heard. At CyberEars.com, we look forward to being your distribution partner for your audio recordings. With CyberEars, it's your audio on your terms.
Thanks, CyberEars.
Remember how we started not so long ago? We dreamed of giving everyone a personal way to grow. Our dream became reality, and now we're making history.
Speaking of buying things, let's talk about gifts. It's a normal segment here where we're going to talk about gifts you could buy your retro computing lovers in your life. Mm-hmm. So, David,
and
what would you
recommend? Retro computing lovers, people need to realize we mean us. So, our addresses are on file.
Well, I think all three of us can agree that this segment is actually kind of difficult, especially to keep it purely retro computing related, you know, so we can
I don't want to hear your excuses, Dave.
We can kind of defer into just geek related. So, but I looked out, I did a search, and I'm almost certain in my video I did for the RCR when I did my little tour, I showed the little stuffed computers I have.
Yes, you did.
And so I thought, hey, just maybe, and I did a search for computer plush. And so I found this.
That's a dangerous search.
It's called My First Laptop Computer Plush Playset by Gund. It's only $13.99. It's very cute. Obviously, it's not specifically retro, but look at the... It's a little laptop with a mouse and a CD. That's kind of retro now. And a little plush case to put it in. So I'm actually going to get one of these, add to my collection, because it's just that cute.
It's a little plush CD. Oh, my God.
And it's cheap, you know? So there you go. I think that's, you know, obviously this really ties in with my own personal... My little plush computer collection, so.
This really is cool. Yeah, good pick, David. I would rather, I have to admit, I'd rather have a plush Altair, but.
Yeah.
If you know.
David, start making those again.
But this is nice.
And what about you, Earl? What would you recommend that people purchase for us?
Well, so I've been looking at videos on 3D printing, and I love the idea of being able to put something together in your head, do like a 3D model of it, and then actually create the physical thing. I mean, it's a brave new world, right? And this can go into retro stuff too, because you create a retro project, maybe an add-on for a retro computer. You want an enclosure. And I've actually seen this done where people have 3D printed an enclosure for a retro electronic add-on device or something. So I got to thinking, I can't afford a 3D printer, even though the price is coming down. And there are these hacker spaces you can go out to, and they've often got resources like for soldering or for 3D printing or small scale construction. So I looked around and I found that Portland actually has a couple of these choices. And a lot of the major cities, you've got these hacker spaces popping up, people who are interested in the electronics, do-it-yourself, the DIY scene. Mm-hmm. And I thought, if you've got somebody in your, you know, a friend or family, loved one who enjoys the maker scene, maybe consider getting them a subscription to your local hackerspace so that they can go. This will give you benefits in two ways. One is it's a very constructive kind of hobby. You know, it's not just sitting on your tush and watching TV. The second thing is it will save you from them wanting to buy their own 3D printer and their own lathe and their own construction kind of stuff. This is wise. Yeah, it's a sharing of resources. So,
plus, it can help you if you get locked out. I see that the one we're linking to, which is Brain Silo, Portland's hackerspace, they on Wednesday, November 30th, they had a college of lockpicking. So,
and actually,
invaluable skills.
Maybe of interest to you, Earl, is this upcoming Wednesday, June 6th, they have a PDX exploit workshop.
Yep. This one seems to be a multifaceted makerspace. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing that caught my eye actually was some of the construction stuff that they had at their, you know, available in their space. And I thought, interesting. My kids are both getting into the microcontroller scene, and mm-hmm. my son was just drooling over the idea of a 3D printer. He looked at that. He just couldn't believe what people are able to do with that stuff these days.
Yeah, it looks really cool. I especially like their webpage design. It's just really nice looking and easy. And, But yeah, it looks like a very cool hacker space. And of course, you know, this ties in with the whole like make fair, make movement. And another interesting thing to note is they had like a workshop, and they have a thing for how to build your own book scanner. That's pretty neat. High-speed do-it-yourself book scanner. They did that 4 months ago, and then they have an upcoming... Well, no, this was 1 month ago where they had a free event book scanning.
Very cool. Yeah, see, isn't this cool? I mean, especially, you know, if
great
you
idea,
want
Earl.
To preserve some of your vintage books and that kind of thing. I know that I've got ones that, in a couple of cases, where there's no copies online. Mm-hmm. In any form, you know, and it'd just be nice to be able to preserve those, so, yeah.
Yeah, just to be clear to everyone, like, it's called Hacker Space. It's not about doing bad hacking or whatever. It's about kind of open source. Well, it's part of the open source share, and let's work together and for the betterment of everybody and make cool stuff. And, you know,
well, it is until I go there and I just stand in order and I say, yes, give in to your anger.
Yeah, no, you know, information security is one of the things that I do in my day job. And I don't know if we've ever talked about that stuff.
Well, you can't spell information security without insecurity, so.
That's true. But one thing that I'll say is there's a lot of controversy about the phrase hacker. And well before hacker meant something bad, people breaking into your systems for malicious purposes, it meant a person who was interested in technology and was creative about the way that they applied it. You know, kind of
out
the box thinking, creative tinkering, exploring, that kind of stuff. And then
Angelina Jolie had to be in a movie.
Exactly. And then later on, you know, it kind of popularized it. Even today, security folks won't refer to them as hackers. It'll be attackers or, you know, different other terms so that you differentiate it from the phrase hacker. So yeah, on this, in no way do I want to imply, you know, go start breaking into computer systems and that kind of stuff.
I, on the other hand, would like to say, go break into some computer systems.
Okay.
One of us has to be the voice of chaos.
They won't take away your CISSP if you say that. So.
When they pry it from my cold, dead, very pale fingers. So that is an awesome choice. That is a great. I want what you picked, Earl. So for me, what I picked is something small. Would be just one component in my long term. Probably all of us have this dream that you have enough money, you have enough space, you have enough free time that you get to have your own home arcade. And I mean a big one, a Flynn's, a something just stuffed full of 80s arcade games. I want Elevator Action. I want Discs of Tron. I want all of these things. There's a hole in my life in the shape of a home arcade. Part of decking that out, I think, would be to have light switches that are themselves working arcade switches. So what I'm picking for this one is a little Etsy item. It's a little pricey at $35.
That's what I was thinking. But it's cool.
It's a light switch. You can pick your own colors. And I do think it's something you could probably build, frankly. But this is the easy way to get it. And they're light switches in the form of traditional arcade game cabinet buttons. So you pick your colors, you pick your backplate, and for $35, you've got yourself a very arcade-looking light switch. Works nice in the home, but for me, it would be one step towards my own little arcade. Tiny, tiny step.
Yeah, I like it. But yeah, the price has to really come down. And I was just doing a search here to see if maybe it was on Kickstarter, which apparently it looks, I mean, as far as I can tell, it looks like it has not been. Right. That seems to me like a great Kickstarter project to where this person could maybe better mass produce them and bring the price down.
Yeah, or honestly, I think it's the kind of thing you could build. It's a switch.
Yeah.
There's not that much to these.
As far as where you get the buttons, I'm sure that's not too hard, right?
That's true, but you know, it's house voltage. And I have to say, I've always loved electronics. I never liked electrical.
Yeah.
I never liked, you know, playing anything with my house, electrical stuff like that. It just, I don't know, it just scares me for some reason.
Oh, I have wired up a lot of house switches. It's like, yeah, whatever.
My wife is the handyman electrician in the house. I've never had to mess with it.
So anyway, that is my...
I think I'll keep her.
well done. Excellent. So guys, let's speaking of things purchased, let's take a quick look at what we picked last episode for auction choices. I had chosen the Apple IIgs System 6, new in the box.
Wow.
It had a couple of bids when we looked at it. It actually went for $82.01. I am quite surprised at how much up for, considering for $15, like we talked about last episode, you can pick yourself up a copy, but not vintage and not in the box. So somebody wants themselves a real copy. Went for $82.
I'm surprised, too. That seems – I don't think any of us thought it'd sell for that much.
Nope. But it did. It went – backed myself a winner, had 15 bids, and it sold from London. I had noticed last time.
You win this round, Carrington.
We haven't looked. Who knows? What about you? Who had you picked last week?
I picked a Kim 1 in a really interesting enclosure that
There's
had
no
been
way
part
that
of an educational series, and it went for over $1,000.
Yeah. How about that?
It's just amazing. I did not see that coming.
I knew it would sell for quite a bit, though, because I'd never seen an enclosure like that, and it looked very, very cool. But I wouldn't have thought $1,076.
I'm telling you, man, the prices are out of control for this stuff. But it was very cool. So somebody got themselves a neat Kim 1 and a neat enclosure for a lot of money.
Yeah,
and if you got the money, it's the kind of thing, well, that's a lot of money. I doubt I would regret a purchase like that because that's a really unique item. So that's really
cool. What about you, David?
Well, I chose the HP 620 Color Palm Top PC with Desk Dock. And so I'd like to give a personal message to our listeners for a moment. You know, I spent a lot of time researching this stuff.
If you don't even go out and bid, where's the love?
What's the point if you're not going to go buy it? So it's still available. I guess 7 days left. Maybe it had 30 before. I don't know. But it's still available for buy it now at $30. Yeah, it's not particularly unique or historical. But
can't even sell yours for $30.
Yeah. Jeez. Oh, and I think I mentioned I had one that was almost just like it. Mine is just a slightly newer version. Actually, I'm looking at it from across. I can't make out. I think it's a 660. So, but anyway, all right. Again, you win this round, Carrington.
No, Earl won. Earl got $1,000. Right. Earl wins. So going forward, so let's look ahead. What are we going to recommend that our ooey gooey listeners scurry out and spend their hard earned pocket money on this? Oh, it looks like I'm first. Okay, so I am picking an M-Size.
Yeah, it's funny why they're calling it this.
Well, they're calling it because it looks like, if you read about it, the description, this is an M-Size, and it's an M-Size, a key early Apple artifact.
Uh-huh.
Because supposedly that this was actually used to something to do with Apple. I can't remember its backstory.
Let's see. Where's this say that? Oh, here it is. The blue box picture here.
It has this huge story behind it. And it was ages ago. I looked at this, and now it's leaked from my brain. I know it's two brothers.
I'm looking, and Randy Wigington, 17-year-old kid who worked part time at Apple, the software engineer. I'm trying to get to wherever they're saying this.
Like it was used in the creation of AppleSoft Basic.
Okay, the M-Size did have three things that the Apple didn't have: a floppy disk drive, a paper tape reader, and a 65-bit cross assembler program. I think I remember reading about that somewhere, maybe. So that's what it was used for. Oh, that's right, because they had a problem. So the timeshare system failed, and magnetic tape that held Randy's work became unreadable, and so they went and got this.
So, piece of Apple history in the form of a non-Apple computer. So they're asking for $15,000 as the starting price.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
It is a very complete system, though, with books and everything.
Yeah.
And a bit of provenance behind it, but it has zero bids and 4 days left. So,
did you notice something else interesting about it?
I didn't notice anything, David.
That who's selling it?
Is it you?
No, it's the same guy selling the Apple One. Early Apple.
He's got a lot of Apple stuff.
With 45 feedback. Where is it located? Saratoga, California. So that's probably...
That's not a real place.
Around, somewhere around Cupertino, Silicon Valley or something, isn't it? What do you think?
I think it's very exciting.
Yeah, but is it worth $15,000 even though it played a key role? Or supposedly played a key role?
No, I'm not into... I wouldn't drop big money on any MSI, even an Apple One. I think it's got an interesting enough history that if I wanted one, I guess I'd pick this one. But I'm picking it more because I thought it was a neat item. I like the M-Size in general. I thought this was one of the more interesting ones to come up for auction.
I think it's a great pick. It'll be really interesting to watch.
Yeah, $15,000 is quite a lot for an M-Size, so we'll see. Even though a really nice looking clean one.
The seller is in Saratoga, California, which is southwest of San Jose, Santa Clara, and it's just immediately south of Cupertino. So, Right. Yeah, it's right there.
And it does come with a thing, a little statement from this, is that you get a signed thing saying, "We, the undersigned, can affirm that this M-Size system was used at Apple Computer Inc. as the code development tool for system software and peripheral ROMs from November 1977 through mid-1979. And so it's signed by Cliff and James, who were Apple employees number 27 and 25.
Huh.
And it is a very, very clean machine. I mean, it's just looks...
Yeah, great. It looks really nice.
Yeah. But $35,000 is a big bunch of money.
No, 15. 15 on this one.
Well, yeah, I'm just happen to say $35,000 is a big bunch of money.
Oh, yeah. it'll be interesting to see, you know, like a lot of the auctions, to see what happens. Will it sell for that or sell the person will lower the price? Next time we'll tell.
Earl, what have you got that can compete with $15,000?
I'm not going to win this round, guys. But again, continuing my apparent fascination for ancient and archaic input-output devices like terminals and punch cards, I have a vintage IBM punch card gauge. So this device would be used to make sure that whatever was punching you out, you know, whether it was a key punch machine or, one of the actual industrial punchers, was actually punching in the right place. So you could take your card, you hold it over this, and you line it up and you make sure that you're calibrated properly for punching out the cards. So it's got a couple bids already, and it just came up. I mean, this basically... this auction just lit up. So currently selling for $5.50, more affordable than the MSI.
Definitely. And frankly, I think I'd rather have this. It'd be kind of neat. It's something I could put on my wall.
Yeah, free shipping too.
Yeah, this is something that you could show people, you know, a little artifact of the past.
I could buy it.
You say free shipping as if it's available to my country.
Does this one say will not ship to Canada?
Yep. Sorry. Only America.
I could get it for you and, you know, ship it to you for, you know, definitely less than 100% premium.
Oh, wow. So better than your usual fee.
Yeah, exactly. It's a discount. Think of it that
excellent.
Way.
You're doing me a solid there. Well, thank you. And David, what have you got that's exciting?
Well, I found an Apple Lisa 2 up on auction, and so I couldn't pass that up to let people become aware. And it'll also be interesting to see what it goes for or not goes for. So they're asking $1,000. Oh, it's got one bid for $1,000. It hasn't met the reserve. $2,500, buy it now.
So the reserve can't be that high.
Yeah. So, you know, they would hope to get the buy it now. What do you think? Reserves maybe $2,000, I bet, something like that.
Right.
Which it looks to be in really good shape. They show it working. It's got lots of stuff with it.
It does, yeah. It is a pretty complete set. It's quite yellowed, mm-hmm. But I like that it comes with all the software and stuff.
It's got some backup stuff, it looks like. You know, a lot of description there. See who's selling it. Good feedback. It's in Arkansas. You know, I'd be honest, I didn't, like, read everything about it, but it, generally speaking, it looks pretty good. It's saying it's functioning. It's not perfect. It's better and more complete than many I've seen on eBay. The monitor has a good solid picture. There's nothing wrong. The artifacts you see in the scan lines, of course, that's just because of the photography.
Sure.
Oh. It'd be tough to find a perfect one these days,
yeah.
Right? But I mean,
yeah.
This being functional like this, I think definitely I've seen, what would you say, David? You're kind of the Lisa expert of the group, but a number of the Lisas that you see on eBay aren't perfect for one reason or another.
Especially, I mean, again, I'm not constantly looking or keeping up with it that well, but especially it seems to me in the last couple of years that they're generally incomplete. Or yeah, not things aren't functioning. So right away, this one's got it. It's got a mouse. Now, I do notice that, which isn't unusual, but the mouse is a Mac mouse, not the actual Lisa mouse. Not a big deal, but
oh, you know, I hadn't spotted that. You're
to
right.
me, that might make it a little more collectible. You know, at least for me, I wanted to have a real Lisa mouse. But, you know, you got the keyboard. And actually, does it have the cards? Yep, it's got the cards that come out, you know, yep. on your side of the keyboard.
Exactly. And like I said, it's got a very nice complete software set, like with the
yeah.
box that software all came in. That's nice. A lot of them don't come with that.
If you look on the screen, it's actually booted the Lisa software, so it has the Lisa ROMs. It can run Lisa OS or MacWorks. You could run the original MacWorks on it. But it says the widget hard drive isn't working, so I guess the person's got to boot it off floppy disk. And that right there, which is... not a surprise. I mean, these things are going to break, but I don't know. That kind of impacts its value to me quite a bit. That, you know, if all you can run with it is off floppy disk, that's going to be pretty horrible to try to... Again, if it's an artifact for you,
new,
who cares? But
you put a new hard drive in it, though. Wouldn't be original, though.
Oh, they're really hard and expensive to come by, those Seagates. Yeah, I've looked for them because I had a profile. Actually, I have it, but it doesn't function at all. It's just for looks to put on top of it. And I've looked on eBay for these original Seagate. Now, this is off the top of my head, but I'm going to say it's like an ST210 or 250 or something. You know, big old full-height hard drive, right?
That big old full-height hard drive.
Yeah, people sell these things like unknown whether they work for $100 and $150 and stuff. So... I mean, it's not
You just drop $2,500
on
your computer. Just cough up the 150 and get a drive.
Oh, wait.
You're going to play in that space.
Oh, it also has the X. Oh, it's got an X profile with it. Oh, so that allows it to... I didn't even see that. It boots off an SD card. The X profile can have a modern ATA hard drive attached. There you go. Well, that's good.
And that's how it boots. Nice.
Yep. So there you go. That definitely adds a lot of value. Because... that's what I have, too, for my Lisa. And those things are about $350 by themselves.
Is this your auction, David?
No. No, unless I hit the worst of times financially, I wouldn't sell mine. That's like the all-time. Even when it doesn't work anymore, that will be the keeper. It's too much a part of my legacy. history. So. All right.
So, guys, I think that's pretty much it for news. Anything you guys want to share of stuff that's happened and stuff that's coming up? What about you, Earl? What do you got? What do you got for the people, for the peeps?
Well, you know, just on a personal note, I just recently got an Apple IIe Platinum. computer. So I have used ADT Pro, the wonderful software that lets you get an operating system for it, even if you have no operating system to begin with.
Right.
I love ADT Pro. So I got that functioning, and I've determined that the computer, the disk drive, everything's working beautifully. Awesome. I do have one little thing. I have to re-glue the 2-key on the computer.
That won't be too hard, though, right? You just got to be careful not to get glue in the plunger part of it or whatever.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be fine. But, I'm very, very happy to be Apple II capable again 6 weeks in advance of Kansas Fest.
Perfect. So, perfect timing.
The other thing, and I tweeted about this, I scored a DBase 3 Plus 1.1 brand new in the shrink wrap on eBay, and it's on its way to me. And you might say, well, so what? But back in the 80s, I made a lot of money and actually did a lot of career work with DBase 3, you know, that database.
You're going to start it up again?
Aptly, I am. I figure it's an untapped market. So,
excellent.
No, it's just, for me, you know, this is like really old home week to get this DBase 3 Plus. And of course, like you, Carrington, I'm going to get it and immediately decimate its value by ripping the shrink wrap off of it.
And that's what I'm talking about.
But videotaping, you know, so I definitely won't get as much
interest. I have been doing a lot of that lately. Videotaping, you know, opening of boxes for the new show coming up. Holy cow, I have videotaped the decimation of a lot of software recently.
But see, it's gaming software, and people will relate to you, whereas, you know, there will be like three people who care about tearing the shrink wrap off of a DBase.
Now, there might be more than you think. I'll have an appreciation for that. In fact, Earl, do you know that two college courses I took early on that were computer related, so I'm about 1992, while I was still in the Army and in Germany, was I took a DBase 3 Plus course and I took a Lotus 1-2-3 course. And I actually enjoyed those two courses a lot.
Nice.
So that's all I ever did with it, the one course. But, you know, I had to actually make a database. I really don't remember a lot of the details now. But I actually enjoyed both of those. They were a real challenge, and it was fun using that.
DBase was a nice development tool for making an application, a database-oriented application, quickly, and having it be user-friendly, and with you could move around the screen real easy. I found it to be a very nice programming environment. I'd been programming all the way back to DBase 2 on CPM, and so, you know, it went all the way through DBase 4 until they finally really kind of started to mess up the product, and then walked away from it at that point.
What happened to it?
I was
that?
A big fan of early DBase stuff.
Well, what happened to DBase ultimately is...
Yeah, did the company also, did they point their users into another product or anything like that, or was it acquired?
No, they were a bunch of D-bags. the
legacy of it, as I recall, is that you might remember when Borland purchased Ashton Tate.
Okay.
And so it became Borland DBase, and they eventually made a program for Windows. But, you know, it seems like all of this was kind of happening at around the same time that SQL-based databases were really starting to take things over, and where you have your database on a back-end system as opposed to having your database run on your local machine or on your Novell LAN or something like that. So I think there were other programs that worked alike and then eventually morphed off on their own, like FoxPro, eventually got bought up by Microsoft and then had a legacy of its own and then died. There was a compiler for DBase that I used a lot called Clipper, originally from a company called Nantucket, but then purchased by Computer Associates, by CA. And now there's an open source thing, I think, called the Harbor Project. And there's another one, too, related. So if you still want to program in this kind of environment, they've tried to keep it up with modern-day constructs. But I think it ultimately just gave way to the modern way of using databases. But boy, back in the day, it was the stuff. And I had a lot of fun, made a lot of money. So I'm looking forward to this thing showing up in the mail.
Very cool.
Nice.
That's it for me.
And David, what about you?
Well, I'm thinking, what do I have to talk about, really, other than at the last show, I know we talked about our videos at YouTube. And so, you know, I tweeted about I added another video where I took an old VHS tape from 1992, and I think it's about 4.5 minutes or something, where it shows like my office at my house in Germany. So I don't think I mentioned that last show.
I don't think it was up by the time you last show. I don't think you had posted it yet.
Right. So if you're interested, go check out our videos, Earl's video too. But look at that. So that's, you know, my house, my computer system, and a little bit of, you can see, actually you'll get to see my original Lisa, not on, but sitting there. And so I did that, and nothing else really to mention. Just I'm really looking forward to Kansas Fest. So just to throw that out there again. So that's July 17th through July 22nd. We're all going to be there. Actually, on the website, it says 1 month and 15 days away.
Excellent.
And yeah, that's all I have really for right now.
Very cool. And for me, I also did finally get around to posting right after our last show. I posted my podcasting set of video, so people want to look at the mics and stuff that I use. And for retro stuff lately, it's just been a lot of gaming. Like I said, I've been recording a lot of videos of me ripping open software for the new video show that's coming out in a couple weeks. And seem to have failed utterly in the building of my little co-hosts. I had two little co-hosts supposed to be working with me, one sort of a refitted it's a typewriter hooked up to a computer underneath like that box, and also a little iPad. And they were emulating Theta and Otto from the old TVO show. Read all about it. But it's,
you can't
like,
get it working.
I can get the working, but in my little space, there's like I can't, since it's just me solo, and I have to record it with two cameras and remotes and be able to zoom in on the TV. Like, it's like I'd have to have foot pedals to record. I'm like, you know what? This is way too complicated. And so I did a couple of them, and I found I'm trying to get this system stuff all in place so that when I relaunch everything, I can keep at it. And I know if I do the show, it might be fun, but if I do it in a way that takes 5 hours to produce it,
yeah,
I'll end up dropping it. So it's got to be something I do a lot easier. So the little I think the co-hosts have to go, and it'll just be me, because it's far easier just to have me and a piece of software to rip open. So I'm going way simpler, but at least I think that means I'll be more likely to be able to stick with it. So I've been recording the stuff that way, and I'm pretty happy with it so far. So in a couple weeks, that will launch along with the 1 megahertz and things. And lately, what I've been doing is playing Exodus Ultima 3. So I've gone back and I've been playing that on an Apple II and having just oodles of fun doing it.
You
need to have operators for your co-hosts, and then they can kind of sit. We watch them watch you, and then they heckle you.
That'd be pretty good, actually.
I was interested when you were talking about building co-hosts. Because I was thinking, you know, if you could build co-hosts, David would have ditched us a long time ago.
David did build us. We're just not aware of it.
We're sentient beings.
Exactly. So it was way too complicated. I'm like, you know what? I'm reach, grasp, I make a sentence out of this. Like, it's just too much. So I've scaled it down considerably, and now I'm having fun doing it. So I've got a few in the can, as it were. So I should get those launched fairly shortly, because I'm actually happy with the setup. But mostly what I've been doing is playing games. So the fun part of this is it's got me back into a lot of gaming for the Apple II, so I'm having a lot of fun doing it. And especially Exodus, Ultima 3, because I played it as a kid, but I never really – and then I picked it up again later, but I never really finished the thing. So I'm really determined to get all the way through to the end of this one. So
I mean, and all three of us know the issue with trying to, you know, keep up on podcasts and stuff, or any project. You got to keep the fun has to outweigh the work.
Well, having co-hosts, I got to tell you, having you guys in this is the reason I've been able to stick with RCR. It is much easier when you've got two other guys you can't let down. You got to be there at the recorded time, and it being a fixed schedule. It's the reason I've knocked out so many double take podcasts, because I have a co-host.
Yeah.
And if it was just me solo, it'd be sitting there in 1 megahertz land just languishing.
I agree.
Yep. So anyway, that's us.
You reminded me of something, Carrington. Have you ever either of you guys played Oregon Trail?
I did not. It's one of the few
years
big
ago.
Apple II games. I've never even touched it. I have a friend, a gal, who's going to be coming over at some point and playing it with me, because it was her favorite game as a kid. So we're going to play it as a duo. She'll walk me through it, and we'll record that. So
I played it as an adult. I mean, I didn't play the whole thing, but I've played it. It was like in the early 90s, and I think it was a color version. And
and we talked, and a few episodes ago, we had that pretend movie trailer, the Oregon Trail movie.
That was good.
Because I was recently chastised for not ever having played Oregon Trail. And I mean, it's doubly ironic because I live in Oregon. I really need to play this game. And
I think we talked about that. I think you were on the right?
Yeah.
We did a show and we talked about it.
So, you know, now that I have an app, now, of course, they had it for a lot of the platforms, but you really, I think you got to play it on the Apple too. So I'm going to get it and play it now also.
Awesome.
I'm not going to record it because I'm probably going to do terribly and die of dysentery. Isn't that what you do in Oregon Trail? So.
Now, don't get too Apple-y on us.
All right.
No, no. Embrace your
anger. We got to keep this balanced.
I'm still one of y'all. Love ya.
Well, that's awesome, guys. So let's wrap things up. I think that sounds like a good way to end our show number 28. I want to thank everybody for listening and for being fans of the show and for taking the time to listen to us three babble on. You can head over to rcrpodcast.com for all the show links and the show notes and links to the blog that only I post in YouTube, guys, and links to the forum where you can also discuss stuff. You can email us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at RCR Podcast. And until next time, I guess, as we always end,
Retro Compute.